Chick Corea and Gary Burton in a somewhat scratchy version of a very beautiful song that Chick Corea wrote, It's In Your Mouse. It's about 4:15. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. This is Fresh Air. My name is Danny Miller. I'm sitting in for Terry Gross while she's enjoying a vacation. My guest in the studio now is Gene London, who is known to more than a generation of Philadelphians as the star of Cartoon Corner's General Store, which was the longest-running local television show featured on WCAU for about 20 years. It went till about 1977. Since leaving television, Gene London has entered the world of costumes. He collects vintage clothing, such as gowns worn by Hollywood stars like Greta Garbo or Lana Turner. He's also gotten involved with costume design for film. This will be one of the focuses of a lecture series Gene London has organized, which will take place at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. It's a four-part series. It'll be every Sunday at 10 a.m., starting January 11th through February 1st in the Van Pelt Auditorium at the Art Museum. In addition to Gene London, there will be other speakers, including Margaret Hamilton, who will discuss the costuming and her portrayal of the Wicked Witch of the West in The Wizard of Oz. Margaret Hamilton will be speaking on January 11th at 10 a.m. in the Van Pelt Auditorium of the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Gene London will be presenting a program the following Sunday on January 18th on the evolution of Disney animation, tracing the history of the studio from their first short cartoons through the development of the full-length Disney features. Gene London worked closely with the Disney Studios when he was producing his television show. He's the only person, by the way, authorized by the Disney Studios to lecture on Disney. Welcome to Fresh Air, Gene.
Hi, Danny.
I know there are a lot of Gene London fans out there that will enjoy a chance to visit with you again.
I'd like to talk to you.
You know, I myself did not grow up in Philadelphia, so I did not have a chance to see your show. However, in telling people that I would be talking to you, I found out that you were a real favorite of a lot of people, and people kept mentioning to me different things that they remembered. Somebody mentioned just sort of the different stories that uh-huh. you'd hear and all the and like the good scares that uh-huh. he'd get. Somebody else mentioned that there was a lot of movies that were recreated on your show uh-huh. with kids doing the acting as a yeah. favorite. I'm wondering, how would you describe the show to somebody like me who didn't have the chance to watch it?
It was wonderful. It was wonderful. I meet people in New York who are, I live in New York now, and I meet people, you can always tell when they recognize you. It kind of like is a glassy look comes over their face and suddenly they're back to whatever age they were when they first fell in love with my program. And I understand why they fell in love with my program, because I was helplessly in love with it and they just saw that through the television screen. I also was very advanced for my time because I was not a macho man. I was a grown man with really, I think, the heart of a child. But if I was confused, I was openly confused. If I was hurt, I openly wept. And there weren't, in those early days, men, males, who were allowed to be openly emotional, openly confused, openly sensitive. And so many people I meet who are now in the arts say that it was Eugene London, Lerner and Lowe that has me now involved in musicals. Or they would compare me to some unbelievably a dynamic figure. And it wasn't because I was dynamic. You must not think any of that. It was because when they looked at the television screen, I was able to go beyond the minimal size of the screen or beyond the isolation of television and go into their minds the way radio did before television came along, the way films did. Enough about that.
It was
just a magic time.
Were there any favorite parts of doing the show in terms of things that you would feature on the show?
Well, I like to draw, and I would draw to music, and I'd show kids how to make things. And people still say that now they're grown up and have children of their own. They say, you know, remember the time when you taught me how to make a jelly roll for my mother for Mother's Day? Now, that was because I innately knew that a lot of kids were too busy to remember to buy their parents presents. And they'd wake up and they'd suddenly turn on television and some would say, today is Mother's Day. And, you know, they would go, Mother's Day, wow, I've got nothing for Ma, and what are they going to do? And so I would teach them how to go in the kitchen and take a piece of white bread and smear it with jelly and then cut off the ends and then roll it up into a roll and then stick a toothpick in it. That mother didn't die swallowing the toothpick is the miracle. But the fantastic thing is that they would do it year after year, or that I would take a pumpkin and hollow it out and make it into a jack-o'-lantern by hollowing out an apple, not a pumpkin, an apple, and a nice big apple, and then cut a face on it and put a birthday candle inside. It was so novel. It was my training that had come from arts and crafts at day camp, at summer camp, as a youngster, that held me in good stead. And then it was my storytelling ability, because when I tell a story, I completely, what you really hope every actor or every artistic technician can do is lose the fact that they're playing to an audience and become completely isolated in what they're doing. It's what a shoemaker does, or what anyone does who really loves their craft.
What lends itself to a good story?
The storyteller. It's someone can tell a story and they make it sound like it's data. Someone else can take a story and improvise on it. Children are very good on that, by the way. So my knowledge of fairy tales had not to do with the fact that fairy tales were make-believe, or the prince was this, or the like it was in the old Shirley Temple Theater, where the princess was always pretty and the prince was always handsome and blonde, or, you know, that awful kind of American graphics. But what was to me is wonderful is that fairy tales to this day, and they're very much misunderstood and are in danger of completely dying off as they were when the Grimm brothers first wrote them down and collected them. When you tell a story of fairy tale, you tell a story of great wisdom in theater. A witch is a cult figure. A witch is the voice of doom. A witch is someone everyone's frightened of. Old people advise young people, be careful, beware. Young people are brash, as they always are. Myths and legends and folklore and Bible stories are so wonderful to tell. Samson and Delilah. I would tell all these stories on my program. And when I would play Samson, I would play Samson. And when I would play Delilah, I would play Delilah. And I was never effeminate, and I was never male. I was always telling a story. And it's even in the way I'm telling it to you now, I'm telling you a story of how I told a story. I'll never forget on my program when I was telling Samson and Delilah, and I was supposed to have a large audience, and all that I had was one 3-year-old kid. That was all. There was no audience, and we were scheduled to tell Samson and Delilah. So I sat the kid on my lap, and I thought, well, I'll sit this one kid on my lap, and I'll tell the story. And I told the story, and the kid was just fine, looking up at me, having a wonderful time, seeing me just animated as heck. And then I came to the story when Samson says, Delilah, place my hands on each side of the columns on both sides. And now step back, Delilah, for I shall push with all my strength, and the columns will fall and fall upon all of us, and we shall be dead. Delilah, move back, Delilah. And the kid began to cry, because as I moved my body and stretched my muscles, the kid suddenly felt as if the whole roof of WCAU was going to collapse on him. And he began to weep. And I remember, just as clear as if this happened today, I remember saying, don't cry. The kid cried. I said, don't cry. The kid still cried. And I looked at the camera and I said, you see the magic of storytelling? When out of your mouth and out of your body comes actions that are so believable that it's like real life. And then I said, you want an ice cream cone, kid? He said, yeah. And we walked off.
That's a beautiful
bribery, didn't it? But it was so much fun. It's just that whole idea that no one tells stories anymore. And television was perfect because one man entertainment, the art of storytelling one-to-one, is like the art of singing one-to-one, or the art of a musician playing one-to-one. My craft is in the arts, drawing and verbalization and acting. But all of us tell a story, as a painter does.
Your fans remember your stories. Part of your stories was having a good scare.
Oh, yeah. Well, you see, I learned that from Disney when I was very, very young. I went to see Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Well, I think the old story is that every seat was soaked in the theater because the kids were so terrified by Snow White. And from Disney, who didn't make pictures for children, he made them for his own satisfaction, made theatrical masterpieces in his early films. I learned that at WCAU doing my program, I could do wonderful, scary programs. I've always been fascinated by old haunted houses. I've always loved things scary. I guess I was pretty advanced in my time because today the theme is scare 'em good. And I did stories that were always fun. I mean, so much fun. A haunted house, a bottomless pit in a cave, echoes, a seance, voices from nowhere, all fairy tales. And also, they were wonderful because with shadows, you could do more than you could with lights. With broken down furniture, you could afford to buy them at a thrift shop or at the Goodwill or Salvation Army for nothing because they were broken down in wonderful shapes that nobody wanted in today's culture. So I was able to fill up half the studio with the most bizarre, beautiful collection. And we could have paintings that had slits where the eyes moved back and forth. We could have trap doors. And it always was lightning and thunder time at the haunted house. And the kids loved it, and I did too.
What else would you do, Gene, to integrate your love of movies and that type of thing?
Well,
if I saw
a program like Gaslight, now, of course, these films were written for adults, so you have to adapt it for children. But since I wrote the story and produced it and starred in it and rehearsed it with my cast, since we had minimal time to rehearse it and since we had no costumes available to us and no budget to work with, I found myself collecting clothes in thrift shops and hanging them on racks behind the studio. And then you never knew what the next program could be, but everything was fair game. For instance, Sleeping Beauty is a story I've been told many times. I might tell the story of Sleeping Beauty, but on my program, a girl might come to visit someone, my boss's wife. Her name was Mrs. Dibley. She was big and fat and smelled good and wonderful and like the mother figure we all adore. And she was very supportive, and my boss was very mean in the program. And you only saw a picture of him, but he always called me up and bawled me out for some mistake that I made. And let's say this girl might come to visit Mrs. Dibley. And, of course, she would come in the store, and we'd be friends. And Miss Dibley would come in and say, we'd take her around town and show her cartoon corners. And I might take her into an antique shop where we might find, among many things, a spinning wheel. And she would touch it, and maybe that night she'd fall into a fitless sleep and almost die, from which she'd become in a coma. And how we would get her back to life again would be our problem, but we'd have to do it. And it would be a much drama, much soap opera for children. In the end, of course, the spinning wheel would have pricked her finger, and the spinning wheel might have been made out of a rare poisonous wood. And once the sliver removed, she became well again, and in that way we would update. Or with Snow White, a girl might come to town who might be a nursery school teacher, and she's got seven children she has to take care of, and one is sleepy, and one is lazy, and one is dopey, and all that kind of thing, and, you know, and someone is jealous and does some kind of nonsense. And each story went on and on and on, the red shoes. There was nothing we didn't do, but remember, we did history as well as fairy tales and legends and Medusa, and, oh gosh, it went on and on.
Where did the inspirations come from? How did you gather your ideas?
Well, as a youngster, I was very, very thin and little. And I was one of four boys in a Russian Jewish immigrant family in Cleveland, Ohio. And I was very artistic. And I didn't know it, but I was madly in love with the movies. I don't think anyone knew it then, back in the 30s. And it wasn't until I was a grown man that my mother told the story to me about how my father had fallen crazy in love with her, head over heels. She was very beautiful, and she had learned from the movies how to have bedroom eyes and how to kind of walk. They said when Minnie walked into a room, the walls danced. And she wouldn't marry my father, and he finally said why, and she confessed that she wanted to become a Spanish dancer in New York City. And he didn't laugh. And he said, well, honey, if that's what you want, then take this. And he brought her an envelope with $200 in it. And he said, Minnie, go to New York. You can live with our relatives and try to make it in show business. And if you can, good. If you can't, don't be ashamed when the money is spent. Come back and marry me and settle down in a real life. And so she went to New York, and then she told me she stayed with the relatives and didn't spend any of the money. She was afraid to go to Broadway. She was too long a subway ride. She came back to Cleveland, gave him back his $200, and married him. But in her fantasy, she was a product of American movies as well. Because in our old scrapbook, I found a picture of her wearing a huge picture hat of lace, looking so glamorous with a lace dress. And I said, Mom, where did you wear this outfit? She said, to a picnic. I said, what? You wore this outfit to a picnic? She said, you don't know what it was like. She said, I came to the picnic, and your Aunt Goldie was the worst of all. She screamed and hooted. I was wearing high heel shoes. And they were wearing the counterpart of jeans and sweaters and slacks and sneakers. And she said that I had learned it from a Dolores del Rio movie, and I thought that was how one goes to a picnic. And I thought that Izzy would come with a basket. Inside would be plastic dishes and knives and forks and spoons with ivory handles and chrome bottles with liqueurs in them. And of course, Zizi came by with a paper bag with an orange and an apple. And she said that I was so much a product of the movies, as I was too, as America was too. Long before there was television, there was radio. But movies in the 30s and the 20s and almost into the 40s was a magic escape place, which was almost more real than life itself. It was the American dream and fairy tale.
One of your early jobs was on radio, actually.
Yeah, on a program called Let's Pretend.
Yeah, you were a funny voice. What was that?
Well, now a lot of people think I'm 75 years old because Let's Pretend started in the 30s. But I came into Let's Pretend when I first came to New York, and that was in the 50s, in the late 50s. And Let's Pretend was a wonderful fairy tale program. You see, on radio, before television, on radio when people could listen to sounds and cook and draw and do anything, even read. It's amazing, but that's true. Radio filled the airways with sounds, with comedians, with drama, with stories. And in the afternoon, there were soap operas like Young Widder Brown and My Gal Sal and Lorenzo Jones, and it just went on and on. And people did their ironing and their washing and their cooking, listened to these soap operas. They were so stupid and so childish, but so much a part of everyone's dream, just as they are now. And then in the evening, from 4 until 6, were the children's half-hour or 15-minute programs like Jack Armstrong, The All-American Boy, or Lone Ranger, or The Green Hornet, and the list went on and on, too. And you flipped from station to station, hearing half of your adventure each time it came to a cliffhanger space, and then tune in tomorrow for the next chapter. And on Saturday mornings, was Let's Pretend That It's Story Time is the song that I adapted when I sang at the Magic Window in Cartoon Corners. But it really was, cream of wheat is so good to eat, yet we have it every day. We sing this song, it'll make us strong, and it makes us shout, hooray! It's good for growing babies and grown-ups too to eat. For all the family's breakfast, you can't beat cream of wheat. Hello, pretenders! That was Uncle Bill. Hello, Uncle Bill! Well, how shall we travel the land of make-believe today? And they would all pick a way of traveling, and off they would go, and each week would be a different fairy tale. Nyla Mack was the redheaded dynamo who did that show, and although I came to the very end of the program, and she died soon when I came, I was able to meet all of these fabulous people I had listened to for years, and I was able to do trick voices like witches, I'll fix you, and voices of tiny little creatures, and just had a terrific time. I first came to New York, I looked very, very young, and I could play any age but myself.
Did you do voices of people? Not magical in the sense of story magical, but perhaps magical because of some...
Of their imitative quality?
Some quality, human quality that you were saying.
No, I just learned to tell stories. Remember, I'd been a puppeteer. As a very young boy, I was a puppeteer. I'd worked with a brilliant woman in Florida when I was very, very young named Sue Hastings. She taught at the University of Miami. And... she taught me how to change my voice, how to play all the parts. And when you do puppeteering, you learn how to act. You learn how to change your voice. You learn how to throw your voice. And you learn how to make your voice, which now is very, very soft, as large as a giant's. So you can make your whole... And your attitude is wonderful. It's such showmanship. So puppeteering gave me in good stead for storytelling. And I love storytelling. I love the one-to-oneness of it.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Gene London, who we've been spending the past 15, 20 minutes talking about some of his experience doing the Cartoon Corners General Store, which was a children's television show that Gene London had on WCAU television for about 20 years. Walt Disney is, I think, thought of as... well, of course, somebody that made a profound difference in the development of animated cartoons and, mm-hmm. and one of the very important pioneers. But he's always had a reputation, I think, as something of, well, both a workaholic and a very hard driver to the people that would work for him, his animators. How did he get that type of reputation?
Well, Walt Disney was born in the Midwest, and when he was in Kansas City as a very young boy after coming back from the First World War, where he served as an ambulance driver because he was too young and because the war had ended just as he joined to become a soldier. When he came out of the service and saved a few dollars, he went to joined an animating firm in Kansas, where he met several of the people that were to follow him in his career when he would finally go to California. One of them was Ub Iwerks. Walt Disney was a genius, a mental genius, a producer. That was his job, to be a producer. Now, a producer is the one person who's able to take all the parts and put them together and make them look as he wants them to look. And that was Walt Disney's genius. But Ub Iwerks was the artist that Walt Disney never was. Walt Disney thought he had to be an artist, had to draw to be a cartoonist. What he had to be was the mental force behind his studio. It was Walt Disney who did not draw Mickey Mouse. Ub Iwerks did. Drew Mickey Mouse.
How did that mental force and that Disney inspiration, how did that influence the organization of the Disney Studios?
Well, Disney was very, very strong. In his early years, when he was doing Oswald the Rabbit, first he had done Alice in Cartoonland. That took him to California. It didn't achieve too much success, and so he abandoned it. It was a series in which a neighborhood girl played the part of Little Alice, and she was superimposed or laid on top of the animated Wonderland. It didn't go anywhere. Then he came up with the idea of Oswald the Rabbit, a rabbit who had kind of zany adventures. And it became kind of a success. And when the contract came for him to renew his contract and maybe ask for more money of the financiers who backed him, he traveled to New York and found that they had indeed made him sign a contract with fine print. And he no longer owned Oswald. Well, this horrified him because he now was married to Lillian, who used to work in his little studio, and he now had artists who were dependent on him for a living. And he also was a success of some degree in his business, and he was looking forward to development. Now he found himself without any vehicle. And so on the train ride back to Los Angeles, they say that he and his wife hit upon the idea of Mortimer Mouse, who was to become Mickey Mouse, who was to become Ub Iwerks' creation in the back room, until he was finished, brought out, and the first cartoon was to be made in silence with no sound, for that was the way cartoons were made then. Of course, no color. And then came sound, and Disney realized that the animation and the strange sounds of music, syncopation, were ideally suited. And so with syncopation, boom, 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 and all these crazy sounds, whistles and horns and this and that, he was able to synchronize movement to the music or sound effects, and it became overnight sensation. The early films in which Mickey Mouse stars were savage in many ways. Disney was born on a farm, and so his kind of outhouse humor pervaded these films. Mickey would take a cat swinger in the air by the tail, would milk a cow's udder to music, even though it caused the cow pain. There was nothing that he didn't do, anything for a laugh. You always saw a bare backside running for an outhouse and the door slamming and someone trying to get in because they had to make two and couldn't get in, and it was just too inane to believe. But this was the style of cartoons, and this was the attitude of Hollywood and America in that particular time of film. But Disney began to realize, as Mickey grew more powerful and as letters came in saying they would not stand for Mickey's terrible antics, that Mickey had to be a gentleman or a gentle mouse. And he knew also that he would have to develop his craft beyond the slavery to just Mickey or Mickey's friends. And so he hit upon the idea, inspired by MGM Studios with its stable of stars, of having different kinds of cartoons. And so he hit upon Silly Symphony, in which they could develop any story they wanted to develop new characters without a word being spoken and just music. Of course, words would be spoken in time. And so The Skeleton Dance was the first film that had sound, that was not a Mickey Mouse cartoon, but was sound to bizarre music. I mean, sound to bizarre pictures. And it was an overnight sensation, getting him another Academy Award. Then he hit upon the idea of putting color into cartoons. So one just followed very quickly, one after the other. He had started Flowers and Trees, a story about the forest where a rough tree falls in love with a willow who moves around like Mae West. It's a very wonderful cartoon. Halfway through, when color became a viable Hollywood product, he said, let's abandon black and white. And everyone said, you're crazy, what are you doing, it's going to cost too much. And he said, I believe in this and I'm going to do it. Now, at the time, there were three partners. One was Walt Disney, the other was his brother Roy, who was a banker by trade and who had become a partner in the Disney organization, and the third one was Ub Iwerks. Remember, that was three. Disney had a magic number, which was three. There were three little pigs, three lives of Thomasina, three lives of Elphaba, and it goes on and on and on. Three is always the magic number with Disney. Well, anyway, they decided that they would scrap all of the black and white footage with flowers and trees, and they would bring it out in color instead, because the forest had to burn, rain had to fall from a blue sky, the fires had to be red, and at the very end there had to be a rainbow. Well, what could be more obvious in a cartoon, which is a child's coloring book picture, than it has to be colored in? And if Walt Disney could color it in, what could be more natural? So from that came Three Little Pigs. Now, Three Little Pigs is the changing tide of art success for Disney, because not only was it able to sell a wonderful storyline as a silly symphony, but it was able to cosmically center on America's need. Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf was what everyone was, because Keep the Wolf from Your Door was on everyone's lip. This was hard times. And so the Three Little Pigs symbolically represented America's naivete and the big bad wolf, which is about to take over their lives.
Disney seemed to have a tremendous affinity for animals, for putting within Three Little Pigs or a mouse or cats, ducks, you know, real human characteristics. How did he achieve that?
Well, he was born and lived in farmlands, and his father didn't approve of him becoming an artist. In fact, he had to draw on the sly. His Aunt Lillian bought him crayons, so the story goes, and he was able to hide his art from his father. When he lived on a farm, they say that he got a nickel, which a nickel is like a dollar and a half or $5 today, for drawing a neighbor's horse. I think it was a doctor. There's another story that there are always owls in Disney films, because when he was a young boy, he climbed up onto the a barn, the second story of the barn on a fence or on a ladder, and he saw an owl and picked it up and wanted to draw it, wanted to look at it closely, but the owl became frightened, and Disney, in his fear, because the owl began to hoot and flap his wings, threw it to the floor and jumped on it and killed it. In many of his early cartoons, there are owls that seem to hover over. His love of the farm must have been born of being surrounded by animals, and his being able to make them into cuddly creatures, remember, was the style of animation in its time. There was a Felix the Cat. There was always.
He had his animators go to zoos and study live-action films of animals.
Well, this was, by then it was mostly for Bambi, when he decided to do Bambi, because that was a realistic drawing in which Cuddly was really out and in was supposed to be realism. In fact, the wonderful thing, you see, Disney was such a genius, I could tell you things that are, I taught this course at the New School. It was the only course ever to be allowed to be taught outside the Disney studio. And when I found in my studying of what I must teach my students that in Cinderella it was the shadows that was the third actress, it was the shadows that followed Cinderella, that followed all the cast, the shadows that, like Hitchcock, were ominous. In Bambi, it was Disney's will that the forest, which was Bambi's home, be understood to be a real forest, and have character, change with the seasons. And Disney brought that to Bambi, a beautiful film. I'm sorry it's too short, but a beautiful film. He was genius. With the success of The Three Little Pigs, which was an outrageous success, and the success of the song, Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf, made millions, millions for the Disney studio, and brought the term piggyback, to be a popular expression in our industry, which means we don't have enough copies to send to every theater. You send it to one, and it's piggybacked to another and sent to another in a different city, so you don't have to have one for each theater. Anyway, it made him so much money that it made Disney realize that he could do a full-length motion picture, and he chose Snow White. Everyone said, Walt, you're out of your mind. In fact, his own industry called it Disney's folly, because they couldn't imagine that anyone would go to see a cartoon that lasted as long as a motion picture, because at that time, no matter how good they were, cartoons were sandwiched usually in between double features with the news and a trailer. But Disney knew that this was the way to make the money, but this was also the way to make a full art form in a full-length motion picture. And so, with The Old Mill, which was another wonderful Disney cartoon in which the multiplane camera was developed, which gave the illusion of depth, Disney was able to give the camera eye, the animation, the eye of a human being, so that things become out of focus further away, or your hand, if you hold up close,
or different planes will move differently at different speeds.
The illusion of depth. And Disney was just, this just tells of Disney's genius. Yes, he was a hard man to work for. Yes, he was very driven. Yes, he was betrayed many, many times. For instance, Ub Iwerk, who was his third partner, went to Disney early in the game. He had been wooed away by another company who promised him his own animation studio. And Disney said, don't you dare do it. If you leave, you're going to break up this wonderful chemistry that we have. Me as the idea man, you as the artist, and Roy as the financial genius. But he could not be talked out of it. So Ub opened his own studio, was an overnight failure, because Ub could draw, but he wasn't an actor and a showman like Disney was.
Well, what were the what type of effects did the sort of cataclysmic events of the Depression and World War II have on the content of Disney films and on the techniques that Disney developed?
Well, with remember that the whole movie industry was changed with the coming of the Second World War. Mayer at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer gave an edict which said that public is tired of fantasy. From now on, they want reality. And we are to make all of our stars handshake real. And Adrian, who was the one who got on the stars at MGM, who made the look for Crawford and for so many stars, Harlow and Garland and Greta Garbo, Adrian said, you mustn't do this because Greta Garbo is a mysterious figure, to which he said, the hell with mystery, this is to be reality, war is coming. And so the movie industry itself changed, and so did Disney. Vodeo Do and Make Mine Music and all of these kind of like trendy, lighter cartoons became popular because Disney was able to give little segments, like your hit parade, like record, give little segments to separate artists to develop, follow through, string them together. And also, you must remember that with the coming of the war, the Disney studios were confiscated by the government, and they had to do war effort things. Not many people realize this, but Disney lost a vast fortune helping in the war
effort. What type of films did Disney
produce? He made cartoons teach men how to fly, made cartoons teach men how to build a tent in the middle of a jungle, made cartoons and insignias for every organization within the war effort, it seems.
Were these Disney characters, and was it Mickey
these
Mouse?
These were Disney characters. Yeah. All of the Walt Disney Studio went to war, and if they could use Bambi, or if they could use the Reluctant Dragon, or if they could use Minnie Mouse, it didn't matter, or if they could cartoon movie characters, it was the Disney touch.
What type of ethnic images cropped up?
In those early years, any minority group was fair game. And if you were black, Yusa was Yessa, Yessa, Yessa with a watermelon and Uncle Tom attitude. If you were Italian, you had a monkey and a hurdy-gurdy and spoke with the Italiana. And every group was... and of course, remember that during the wartime, the Orientals were... portrayed as yellow and as Axis and as always out to get you. And remember also that the Germans were the Huns and the Gestapo and of course out of that came Sieg Heil, right in the Führer's face. It's a wonderful song that made great chemistry in its time.
Can you just briefly tell us how your interest in costumes derived and sort of how that relates to the rest of your
work?
Well,
remember when I did my show, we could not afford costumes. We talked about that. So I had a whole room filled with wardrobe, and many movie stars came to visit my program and saw this wardrobe department, were intrigued by it, and sent me back clothes to hang among the rack. And they were Lucille Ball and Joan Crawford and so many stars. So when I was out of business and the show finally, after so many years, went off and the magic was gone, I looked about to kind of pull my life together and see, well, what's the next step, Gene? And I had all of these costumes. And the time was right in fashion market for me to focus on the fact that Hollywood for years gave the world its look. The wealthy went to Paris and New York, but the people went to the movies to see what the latest styles were in hairdos, in makeup, in clothing, even in furnishings. Writers gave them the words. They said the lighting man made them look as best they could. Special effects were made to take them to places that they never left the studio walls. But it was the look that they had which gave America and the world the look of Hollywood. Hollywood has never been given proper credit for this. And so I found myself lecturing on this subject and presenting my clothes to buyers, to businesses. My clothes are in Sweeney Todd. Almost the whole show is Franny Lee's collecting of my clothes and putting them on Angela Lansbury's back, her apron, and so many of the things.
Is the new gown that Angela Lansbury wears, is that from your Gannett collection?
I guess so. It's been a long time since I saw that show.
What are some of your most prized possessions of gowns and
vintage
clothes?
Know. I have so many. There's a Bailey Banks and Biddle catalog. If any of you people are going by Bailey Banks and Biddle, if you want to go in and pick up my catalog, it's Timeless Fashions for Timeless Jewelry. And in it, you can see all of my fashions page by page.
Who do you enjoy talking about fashions with? You're mentioning all these people that were dropping in.
I love talking fashion. I talk with fashion with anybody. To me, you see fashion is a sign of the time. It's an art form.
Are there people from Hollywood that you really found a rapport with in terms of the people that would wear fashions?
I find rapport with everyone. I very seldom ever found anyone I didn't have a rapport with, whether it was talking about fashion or whatever it is. This series is particularly wonderful because had I been a kid to have gone to a series like this, I would have died to have been allowed to have come to a series in which the behind-the-scenes look of Hollywood is provided for the person to be able to talk with the stars about the making of the movie, to be able to see scenes that you can't see in the finished film, to be able to see flaws explained, to be able to understand problems. Judy Garland had so many problems. She wasn't the first choice for The Wizard of Oz. It was Shirley Temple. W.C. Fields was supposed to play the wizard. Gail Sondergaard was supposed to play the witch. To have Maggie Hamilton talk about the making of the movie. We're also going to have the Munchkin on the same show who played as Cora. I examined her. I legally examined her, and she is not just merely dead. She's absolutely and sincerely dead. Well, he's going to come and talk about being the Munchkins in that film, what it was like to play their parts, how they learned their lines. Did you know that there were 30 makeup chairs for the Munchkins? There were, I don't know how many, 300 Munchkins or something? And the way they all went from chair to chair, the first chair they had their face washed, the second chair they had their foundation put on, the third chair they had their noses put on, the fourth chair they had their lipstick put on, the fifth chair they had their cheeks put on. And so it went for 30 chairs until they were done. Judy Garland often said that she thought that the Munchkins were lascivious and dirty and all kinds of bad things. Well, we're going to find out if that's really true because he's going to tell us from his own lips. Now, The Wizard of Oz will have costumes from the show on exhibit. We'll see the movie. We'll talk about the making of the movie. The Wizard of Oz Club will tell you how you can join the club, tell you all kinds of things they know about it. On the second show, which is The Evolution of Animation, I'll tell you all about Walt Disney and show you the films I was talking about earlier. There'll be cells, there'll be drawings, there'll be mementos and showcases you can study about animation and the private life of Disney. And something that's very curious that I found in an antique shop a long time ago and have kept a secret all these years. When I was stumbling through an antique shop, I saw a Mickey Mouse. And on the back of it was a trademark, and the name was misspelled. It was M-I-C-K-Y. And the trademark was 1926. But Mickey Mouse wasn't invented until 1928. And his name is spelled M-I-C-K-E-Y. Was Mickey indeed a ripoff by Walt Disney? Did he find it in New York when he went to work out the thing with Oswald the Rabbit? Did he have it with him when he went back to the studio? Did they steal the idea from Mickey? It's something to think about. On the third show, there'll be the making of a monster. We'll be showing King Kong and talking with Stephen Vortlieb, the King Kong expert in this area. He'll be telling about giant puppets like King Kong. Also, we'll be having what is the name of that wonderful cartoonist?
Bill Baird.
Bill Baird, I'm so sorry, the puppeteer. We'll be having Bill Baird on, who's a brilliant puppeteer, and he'll be talking about it. We'll also be having the man who created Big Bird, and he'll be bringing Big Bird to the show and talking about the making of a giant puppet like Big Bird. And on the last show, last but not least, we'll be going science fiction costuming from Frankenstein to Star Wars. And we'll be showing some of Frankenstein, Kerry Robbins, who's designed the new Frankenstein, which has come to Broadway. We'll be talking about adapting Frankenstein for the stage. And then we'll be having one of the artists from Star Wars who'll be showing costume designs, talking about the making of that brilliant film, as well as Wes Shank, who's going to be bringing science fiction things that will blow our minds. There was a movie called The Blob, and it was a 50s wonder movie. It was the worst and the best. And The Blob oozes underneath a door frame and comes into the room. Well, how do they do that? He has the bottle of green slime that was supposed to be the blob. And the way they did it was they took the miniature room, tilted it on its side, put the ooze on the other side of the crack of the bottom of the door, and then made it look as if it were going across a flat floor. These were the tricks of science fiction movies. And this will be what the series will be like, which will be at the Philadelphia Museum.
Right. The series that Gene is talking about is a series that he's organized called Hollywood's Film Fantasies at the Philadelphia Museum. It'll be on Sundays, starting Sunday, January 11th, for four Sundays. That's through February 1st at Van Pelt Auditorium at 10 a.m. And admission is free. It'll be a combination of films and people talking about their experiences in participating in the making of these films. And Gene London will be the host of the series, and also giving a lecture on January 18th on the evolution of Walt Disney Animation. Well, I want to thank you very much, Gene, for coming here. I wonder if there'll be many Gene London fans coming up to you from seeing your show. And
I'd love it. I also would like to say that we're expecting a huge audience, and the theater holds 370 people. And if you do come late, or if there's not room for you, they will have television facilities in the lobby of the Art Museum, so you can see it there. And if you do want to have autographs from Maggie Hamilton or from any of the people coming in this series, or ask them questions, I hope they'll have time to talk to you, because it's all part of the magic of this kind of very unique lecture for the Treasure Palace, the Museum of Philadelphia.
Well, thanks again, Gene.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Gene London, and he's organizing the series that we've just been talking about. And Gene London is also, yes, the person that you saw on WCAU on the Cartoon Corner's General Store, which was a children's show running in Philadelphia. It ran for about 20 years, making it the longest-running local television children's show. Well, that's about it for today's Fresh Air. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, at 3 o'clock, we'll continue with the Choosing the Future series, a series of programs which we've been featuring this week on Fresh Air. It's a set of discussions with some of the people who are the thinkers and the ones who have to ask the questions and make certain decisions regarding the future. So that'll be at 3 o'clock. At 3:30 every Wednesday at 3:30, we're joined by John Zwed, who will review a new jazz release. At 4 o'clock, we'll be speaking with Al Balk over the phone. Al Balk is in New York, and he's the editor of the World Press Review, a magazine which surveys what different papers all over the world are saying about world events, and we'll take a look back at how the World Press covered the world and how the United States fared in the eyes of the world. At about 4:15, we'll be joined by somebody who's been on Fresh Air in the past, and that's Ralph Moore, who is at St. Mary's Church of the Christian Association on the University of Pennsylvania campus. And we're going to be talking about the process of making decisions on how to change, which is somewhat appropriate for a New Year's Eve, because now is a traditional time to start making resolutions on how you'd like to change some things in your life and some things you do well at in changing. Perhaps some things don't go as well. We'll talk to Ralph more about that type of process of decision making and open the phones to find out what type of New Year's resolutions you have in mind. Well, that's it for today's Fresh Air. Production assistance today was provided by Maeve McGoran, and technical supervision by Paul Keller. My name is Danny Miller. I'm sitting in for Terry Gross while she enjoys vacation, and I'd like to thank you for listening. Have a great evening. Bye-bye. Thank you. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Robert Krulwich.
And I'm Jackie Judd with All Things Considered.
Like that, if you teach children that things just occurred with no purpose, that actually the beginning was an accident, and that they evolved from an animal, that's difficult for young people.
Carolyn Sanford lives in Georgia. She has a child who is studying evolution in school, and she wants the school to teach biblical creation as well. Tonight on All Things Considered, we hear from parents and teachers across the country who debate the question, if you're going to teach evolution, must you also teach creation?
Also tonight, these stories, Iran gives the Algerian middlemen more freedom to negotiate release of the hostages.
More information about the controversial report on American cities in the 80s. A top advisor tells President Carter to disavow the study.
1980 was a big year for the world supply of money. It increased 10%, and that apparently is too much.
The best and worst of inflation, list of what countries were hardest hit and those who aren't doing so badly.
After 26 years, NBC drops The Wonderful World of Disney from its TV lineup.
First, Richard Harris has this news.
The United States has put the finishing touches on its next formal message to Iran, but officials don't think it'll lead to a breakthrough. The U.S. has already rejected putting down a $24 billion guarantee toward the hostages' freedom, and the State Department says its latest reply is not much different than the ones before. The Iranian in charge of hostage negotiations says Iran is ready to listen to any new proposals as long as they include Tehran's demand of financial guarantees. And Behzad Nabavi says if the proposals are all right with the Algerian go-betweens, they'll be all right with Iran. The U.S. says it will restore Iran's assets once the hostages are freed, but guarantees, other than verbal, are out of the question. All this has been explained to the Algerians, and they'll explain it to the Iranians. Nabavi says if no solution is found, the hostages go on trial. President Carter has virtually conceded that the hostages won't be home before he leaves office. White House spokesman Jody Powell says the president believes it's highly unlikely. Private farmers in Poland have, for the moment, shelved plans for a food strike after the Supreme Court today postponed a decision on whether to legalize a private farmers' union. Farmers reacted favorably to the delay, as the BBC's Tim Sebastian reports from Warsaw.
The feeling among the farmers was that because they hadn't lost their appeal, they must have won something. A union spokesman told a news conference, whether they like it or not, the authorities have to take account of our existence. The postponement itself came after judges said they needed more time to study the union's documents and would consult further with the state prosecutor. The impression is that the authorities may well attempt to put forward alternative proposals instead of allowing the union full legal status. But a move like that would be bound to reopen the arguments and might then involve open intervention by the powerful free trade union leaders. Although the farmers seem to have withdrawn their threat to disrupt supplies, they still mean to get their union registered. Among other things, they say, it would give them the legal right to strike. And it could be that the country is facing a further period of difficult industrial relations. Tim Sebastian, BBC, Warsaw.
The Pentagon today accused Japan of complacency for failing to increase defense spending as much as the U.S. would like. The Carter administration wanted Tokyo to boost its relatively small defense outlays by nearly 10%, but Japan plans only a 7.6% increase. That's seriously short, the Pentagon says, in light of how much the Soviets spend on their military. Stocking the U.S. arsenal with new weapons might impair this country's ability to fight a war. Representative Bob Carr of Michigan says Congress doesn't pay enough attention to the money needed to support the weapons. When a new weapons system is proposed, he says, the weapons lobbyists flock to Washington.
On the other hand, there is no constituency on behalf of more flight training hours for our fighter pilots, for more ship steaming days for our Navy, for more funding for exercises, for the Army.
Carr today released a report on all this. He's a member of the House Armed Services Committee who lost his re-election bid last month. Nigeria is joining other OPEC producers in raising the price of its oil. The increase of $3 a barrel is less than anticipated. Nigeria usually follows Libya's lead, and Libya is hiking prices $4 to the cartel ceiling price of $41 per barrel. Nigeria supplies 5% of U.S. imports, second only to Saudi Arabia. This latest round of OPEC increases will raise the price of American gasoline by as much as 8 cents a gallon. A reduction in oil imports to the lowest level in 4.5 years narrowed the U.S. trade deficit last month to $1.2 billion. Stock prices closed the day mixed. The Dow Jones Industrials gained 1.5 in moderate trading. An inside look at the Carter administration from former State Department spokesman Hodding Carter. Here's Chris Graham in Chicago.
Writing in the February issue of Playboy magazine, Hodding Carter takes apart the president's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, calling him a second-rate thinker who was always trying to plug leaks he thought might damage his own prestige. He likened Brzezinski to a rat terrier and wonders aloud why President Carter was unable to choose between Brzezinski and former Secretary of State Cyrus Vance. Hodding Carter also charges that what he terms the president's almost willful inconsistencies ended up damaging American standing at home and overseas. Chris Graham, Chicago.
In Washington, a spokesman for Brzezinski was asked how the National Security Advisor feels about the article. "We don't comment on nonsense," he said. Former First Lady Bess Truman was admitted to Research Hospital in Independence, Missouri today for observation. The 94-year-old widow of President Harry Truman complained of skin irritation and a urinary tract condition. Singer-songwriter Tim Harton was found dead last night at his Hollywood apartment. He was 39. The folk singer remained largely unknown while his songs gained fame sung by others. His most famous composition, "If I Were a Carpenter." I'm Richard Harris in Washington.
White House spokesman Jody Powell said today that President Carter now believes that the 52 American hostages in Iran will not be released before he leaves office on January 20th. Powell said the chances for an earlier release have been considerably diminished because of Iran's demand for $24 billion in guarantees from the United States. Nevertheless, there were indications on both sides today that negotiations will continue. From Tehran, New York Times correspondent John Kiffner says that there were at least some moderately encouraging words from a high Iranian official.
Behzad Navavi, whose title is the Executive Affairs Minister, who's been the official most directly involved in the negotiations over the last 2 months or so, since the members of the kind of Islamic traditionalist faction have taken the initiative on the hostage issue here. He said two interesting things at a press conference this morning. First, in answer to a question of whether the response the United States had made, the United States offer, if you set aside the question of guarantees, if you just looked at that offer on the face of it, was that acceptable? And he said, yes, generally it was acceptable. And it was that acceptability that had caused them to then come back with their famous $24 billion deposit scheme. Now, the second thing he said was that he appeared to indicate that it was possible that maybe some other kind of guarantees, other than the $24 billion, might be found. He said that if there was a kind of a guarantee which is accepted by the Algerian government, we can accept it too.
Hmm. That puts the Algerians in a much more important position all of a sudden.
Right, and they've been, they're apparently talking to the State Department today for the fourth day. So, I mean, I assume they're doing something more than munching bonbons.
Well, let me back up a little bit to make sure I understand what you've told me. You say that the press conference tells you or suggests that the Iranians are happy with all parts of the plan except they want money up front?
Basically, yes.
And now what you have to do is you have to figure out a new, United States has to come up with, in their opinion, a new formula to guarantee the money.
Yeah, that seems to be what we're dealing with here. Now, the conditions were released a couple of days ago, first by Iran, then by the United States. And as I think you probably saw at the time, it appeared the United States had agreed to all the Iranian demands. They'd agreed to unfreeze the assets, to revoke the economic sanctions, to freeze the Shah's wealth, try and help find it. And even, which surprised me, to cancel the lawsuits, the American suits by American companies and individuals. And this was certainly something farther than I think most people had thought they would be able to go.
Well, did you sense standing there that this was a press conference called to keep lines open and to keep conversation going, that they were surprised somehow by the reaction back in the States?
Well, I think they may be surprised by the action. This is a press conference that Nabavi has been taking to having regularly on Tuesdays the last several weeks.
So it was regularly scheduled, but it was the tone an invitation to have more conversation? That's what it sounds like here.
It would seem to be. Certainly, they've tried to make it clear, it seems to me, over the last few days that things are still open.
New York Times correspondent John Kiffner speaking to us from Tehran. Jackie?
Here in Washington, State Department officials have completed 4 days of talks with the Algerian diplomats dealing with the hostage issue. The Algerians left the United States carrying the latest American response to Iran. NPR's William Drummond has more from the State Department.
This round of talks between the Algerian diplomats and the U.S. negotiating team was the longest yet. They covered 4 whole days. The U.S. had already termed Iran's demands for billions of dollars as collateral to be unreasonable, but clearly the latest response from the State Department will be more than a simple no. Deputy Secretary of State Warren Christopher said goodbye to the Algerians shortly after 4 this afternoon. He said they would carry the U.S. message to Tehran after the Algerians confer with their own foreign minister.
Since the beginning of this matter, we've been governed by 2 basic principles. First, to seek a prompt and safe return of the hostages. And second, to do so in a way that is consistent with our national interest and with our national honor. Our most recent response, the one that they're carrying back, is faithful to these 2 basic principles. It represents a reformulation of the United States position in a way that will enable the 2 governments, that is the American government and the Iranian government, to reach a prompt resolution of the matter if the Iranians are willing and able to do so.
Christopher would not answer questions from reporters, so there is no way of knowing what the reformulation of the U.S. proposals amount to. But this morning, sources said that the problem was to provide the Iranians with some assurances that the U.S. would carry out its part of the bargain after January 20th.
This tragic event happened on our watch, if I may use an old Navy term. We hope very much that we can bring it to a successful conclusion on our watch. At the same time, we are quite determined to turn it over to our successors, if that be the destiny, in a way that's consistent with our national interest, our national honor, and in a way that reflects our determination to have a safe return of the hostages.
Christopher was profuse in his thanks to the Algerians for the role they have played. He pointed specifically to Ambassador Gharib's visit to the 52 Americans on Christmas Day. Christopher gave no indication of an upgrading of their role in the diplomatic exchanges. And earlier today at the State Department briefing, the spokesman said the U.S. considered the Algerians to be intermediaries. The spokesman declined to comment on the statements from Iran suggesting that the Algerians would be given the final responsibility of deciding on the terms for the return of the hostages. At the State Department, I'm William Drummond.